My plan is to talk to you about intermediate mass X-ray binaries. And as you know, there are high mass X-ray binaries and low mass X-ray binaries. But especially from observing radio pulsars in binaries with rather massive white dwarf companions, it has become clear that there is also must be an intermediate class that means this companions which are not low mass or high mass, but somewhere in between. And I hope to convince you in this afternoon that this class does exist. Get into the evidence on these objects. Now first, why do we have the usual, which we already know almost 30 years now, 28 years, why do we have the low mass and the high mass X-ray binaries? Well, the Eddington limit, I'm sure you are all familiar with. An object which is radiating has a maximum luminosity, which, assuming that the object is surrounded by ionized hydrogen, or has an atmosphere of ionized hydrogen, which is called the Eddington limit. And the Eddington limit, when the luminosity goes up and up and up, the radiation pressure on the surroundings increases, and at a certain point it gets larger than the gravitational attraction to the matter, so matter is being blown away. And this, if you assume that the surrounding matter is just ionized hydrogen, the opacity is given by electron scattering, and then you get that the Eddington limit is roughly 2 times 10 to the 38 times the mass of the object in solar masses in arcs per second. If the luminosity goes above that, you blow away the hydrogen around it. Yeah. Now, if you have an accreting object, like a neutron star, the accretion luminosity, of course, is given by the gravitational energy release, by the accretion rate. And so when you increase the accretion rate, there comes a moment that the luminosity gets equal to the Eddington luminosity. You cannot basically accrete more than this Eddington accretion rate. And for a neutron star, typical mass, Chandrasekhar mass and a radius 10 kilometers is about 2 times 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year. Of course, this is all old stuff, but when the accretion rate onto a neutron star gets above this, as from a companion, the excess matter which is being transferred to the star will be blown away. Or it will be just, you get a lot of matter around and the X-rays may be degraded and you may not see it anymore. So if you really want to make a steady, observable X-ray source, then you must have a companion that just transfers matter at a rate lower than this on a relatively long time scale so that you can keep seeing the X-ray source. Now, we know in nature, of course, that we have the two types, the high mass and the low mass X-ray binaries, and this is all pretty old stuff. The high mass X-ray binaries was already pointed out by Davidson and Ostreicher in 73 when these were discovered, that you see a neutron star going around or a black hole going around a blue supergiant star. And we know also since the early 70s, the late 60s from UV observations that blue supergiants with masses above say 15 to 20 solar masses have very strong winds, large wind mass loss rates with high velocities. And this high velocity wind, a tiny fraction of it will be captured by the neutron star. The order of 10 to the minus 4 because of this high velocity. Most of the wind just disappears into space with only matter which passes very closely along the neutron star can be captured gravitationally. And so you get typical accretion rates of 10 to the minus 10. And you can make a nice and steady X-ray source in this way. The other mode of mass transfer you can have is, of course, Roche-Lobe overflow. The star fills its Roche-Lobe and transfers matter to the companion. In that case, the velocities are low, and you expect basically most of the accreted or all of the accreted matter to be captured. Yeah. Now, if you now make a thought experiment and ask yourself if you have a neutron star and masses of all kinds between low and very high. If nature would produce all of those, which systems, which companions could then produce a steady, a persistent X-ray source with accretion rate below the Eddington rate? If you make that salt experiment, then the outcome is that just these two types, with a high mass star and with a low mass companion, less than a solar mass, would appear in nature. And the reason for that is that when you look at Rochlope overflow, you have, with Rochlope overflow, you have, if the companion star is more massive than the accretor, that if you have a star with a radiative envelope, the star M1, then the time scale for the mass transfer is typically the thermal time scale of the donor star. This is because a star, when the more massive star transfers mass to the less massive star, the system shrinks due to conservation of orbital angular momentum and mass. And when this star fills its Rochlope, if it's a star which has gradually been evolving, the star wants to get larger, but when mass is being transferred, its Rochlope gets smaller, and when the star tries to reestablish its thermal equilibrium, it will expand again, and while the Rochlope is decreasing, so it has to keep transferring matter until you reach a stage that the star has become less massive, and then when the mass transfer continues, the system will widen, and then the two, increase in radius can keep pace with the increase in the Rochlope, so you go back to a stable situation. But in this situation, you will have mass transfer on a rather short time scale, the time scale for the star to reestablish its thermal equilibrium with the thermal time scale. In this case, the expansion will go, again, the star can be stable and expand on the nuclear time scale, so the mass transfer time scale is typically a nuclear time scale. Now, if you go into the equations for the thermal time scale, then you find that if the donor is more massive than the neutron star, the thermal time scale is, it's rather trivial stuff, is typically of the order of 3 × 10⁷ years divided by the mass of the star squared in solar masses. So the mass transfer rate you get is the envelope mass of the star divided by the thermal time scale, and going through these equations you easily see that it's a few times 10⁻⁸ times the mass of the star in solar units. So what you see is that if you want by Rochlope overflow to get a mass transfer rate which is below the Eddington limit, the star cannot be larger than about the solar mass. And that means that, now if you go through this Gedanken experiment, that nature would make all kinds of companions to neutron stars, that only when you go below a solar mass companion, you can have a steady X-ray source. And on the other hand, if you go to the very high masses, only above 15 solar masses, the stars get such large wind velocities, wind mass loss rates, that there again, by capturing a bit of wind matter, you can have an X-ray source. So the reason why we have the high mass X-ray blindness and the low mass X-ray blindness is not because nature would only make neutron stars next to low mass stars or only next to very high mass stars, but it's only because there is a mode of mass transfer available in these stars larger than 15 or less than one solar mass, a mode of mass transfer available that can produce a steady X-ray source. Now, in the low mass case, of course, here, when you have a mass less than a solar mass, you are, in fact, if the neutron star is 1.4, you are in the case where the mass transfer would be stable on a nuclear time scale. So you get basically a very low mass transfer rate because the nuclear time scale is something like 10 to 10 years. And so you would get typically of the order of 10⁻¹⁰ solar masses a year transfer But there are other mechanisms people have been thinking about. That's also long known that, of course, these systems are very narrow, and gravitational radiation losses may also drive the mass transfer. You don't even need the evolution of the companion star, or magnetic braking can drive it. But in any case, you get mass transfer rates which do not exceed the Eddington limit. So this is all well-known stuff, I presume. But it indicates that there could very well be companions to neutron stars of all kinds of other masses. And of course, already in the 70s, the first group of companions was discovered, which are in this intermediate range between 1 and, say, 15 or 20 solar masses. These are not steady sources, but these are transients, the B-emission transients. These are rather wide binaries with orbital periods up to over a year, between 17 days and over a year. They are not steady sources, but they from time to time appear as an X-ray source, as a transient, and that's due to the fact that the emission star is a main sequence star with a mass typically somewhere between 8 and 20 solar masses. A rather unevolved, rapidly rotating star. And these stars are well known to, from time to time, by some mechanism not well known, to eject matter in their equatorial plane. They are very rapidly rotating. They do this sometimes with an interval of a couple of years. Sometimes they may even be quiet for a decade or so, but then suddenly they eject a disk of gas, and then the star, when it goes through it, the neutron star goes through it, you get periodic outbursts a couple of times, and then the thing goes back into quiescence again. So, and this is a very common group of X-ray binaries. There are more than 50 of them known now. Even a dozen of them has been found in the Small Magellanic Cloud. So these things do exist in large numbers in our galaxy, probably thousands of them, which only from time to time appear as an X-ray source. So we see already that between 8 and 20, there are companions available, only they do not produce a steady, persistent X-ray source. And also on the low end, already from the very beginning, there were companions that people tried to class as low mass, but if you really look into detail, they are not really low mass. For example, Hercules X1 has a companion of 2 solar masses, star which has a luminosity of about 20 solar luminosities, and which has an A-type spectrum. And only recently people have realized that Cygnus X2, a well-known low mass X-ray binary, probably is not that low mass, or was not that low mass to begin with. The spectrum of the companion star in that system is always visible, while if you look at the other low mass X-ray binaries, you only see the spectrum of an accretion disk. So here the companions are really low mass stars, and the accretion disk outshines the companion star. But in Cygnus X2, you always see the spectrum of the star, which means that the star must be pretty luminous, somewhere between 20 and 50 solar luminosities. On the other hand, it's a rather wide system, almost 10-day orbit. It has a rather small mass, but you can only get an object with a small mass and such a large luminosity if it is the remnant of a quite a bit larger star. It must have at least been a star when it left the main sequence of more than 2 solar masses. That was recently realized by a number of people, and because of that, now the idea has been introduced by King and Ritter last year, and also by Podziatlowski and Rappaport, and also by ourselves, that actually Cygnus X2 and such systems should be not called low mass X-ray binaries, but intermediate mass X-ray binaries. An intermediate meaning between say 1 and somewhere a couple of solar masses at least. Now, from a completely different side, we also have evidence that such companions, say in the range between 1 and 8 solar masses or so, must occur quite a lot to neutron stars, and that comes from the pulsars, the radio pulsars. I presume you have seen this picture quite a lot of times in this meeting. But but you have not seen it probably in the way I present it here, I hope. This is from the last version from an article by Dick Manchester in the Radio Pulse Symposium of last year. Now, for the moment, I do not look at the upper part because that's for other people like the magnetar guys and so. I look at the lower part, and I have put in quite a lot of colors. Now, first of all, we have the millisecond pulses in binaries. All the things with circles are binaries. So these are binary pulses, the binary millisecond pulses. These are all systems with low mass, the black ones, with low mass white dwarf companions. The neutron star is a millisecond pulsar. The orbits are circular. The green ones also are systems with circular orbits, with a short period pulsar with a low magnetic field, and but in this case with high mass white dwarfs, which means somewhere between half a solar mass and 1.2 solar masses. These are the green ones, and it's just recently from the Parkes multi-beam survey that a lot of new systems of that type have been discovered. The blue ones are double neutron stars. Yeah, there is one square that's in a globular cluster. I wanted to indicate the globular cluster in a little different way. So the blue ones are the double neutron stars. There are five of them. They all, these guys all have circular orbits. The double neutron stars have eccentric orbits, of course, because there were two supernovae and the last supernova in the system made the orbit eccentric. So these are already three categories of binary pulsars, but there are more, because as Madden van Kerkwijk and Kulkarni discovered, this guy, which we always thought was a double neutron star because it has an eccentric orbit, has a massive white dwarf as a companion. So it's not a double neutron star, it's an eccentric system consisting of a not recycled neutron star plus a white dwarf. And probably this one is of the same type. This was discovered in the Parkes multi-beam survey. That's another category. So these guys are recycled. And I don't know whether the recycling has been discussed a lot here in this meeting. Has it been discussed? Oh,
yeah.
Let me at least a neutron star in a born in a binary system has basically the possibility to live twice as a pulsar. First after when it's born somewhere with a high magnetic field and with a short spin period. Then this is the diagram where magnetic field strength is plotted against pulse period. It's the same diagram as I showed, but turned around a little bit. Now this pulsar spins down, it gets into the graveyard. And when it is in a binary system, there comes a moment that the companion begins to transfer mass to it. For some reason, the magnetic field strength in these binary systems with mass transfer goes down. And at the lower field strengths, when the star is spun up, it can get into the region of the living pulsars again. So it can cross the death line again. You can spin it up at most up to the spin-up line. This is the line where the equilibrium spin period for the Eddington accretion rate is indicated. So this is the maximum where you can spin it up. And so the binary pulsars with white dwarf companions or with neutron star companions, they have been recycled in this way through the magnetic field strengths against period diagram and have finished up with short spin periods and weak magnetic fields in this lower corner of the diagram. And so basically these guys are all recycled. But these are not recycled and they have white dwarf companions. Now, I have already four categories, but there is a fifth one, and that is neutron stars which are not recycled and do not have a dead companion like a white dwarf or a neutron star, but just have an ordinary star as a companion, a B-type star. And there are three of them, of which we have know that two of them have a B star. The third one we don't really know, but those are those three. They have a massive star as a companion. They have very eccentric orbits, the result of the supernova explosion. And maybe I should show just flash how these systems all look like. So the first of all, the millisecond ones in the circular orbits with a low mass white dwarf companion, a helium white dwarf companion, they always have circular orbits. The double neutron stars, of course, have eccentric orbits but are recycled. But we have also massive white dwarfs with a recycled pulsar. And they have circular orbits because there was not a second supernova in the system to make the orbit not circular. And then, of course, we have the systems with the massive white dwarfs with a young pulsar, not recycled pulsar. For some reason or another, the white dwarf was first born in the system, and the neutron star was later born in a supernova which made the orbit eccentric. And we think there are two of those systems. So you see already four different types of binary pulsars in this picture. And then the fifth type is the one with the unevolved star as a companion, which are extremely eccentric, of which I have two of them here now. This is a young pulsar going around to be an emission star in a very eccentric orbit. 0.87, 15 solar mass star. And then there is one in the Large Magellanic Cloud. The only pulsar discovered in the Large Magellanic Cloud happened to be, or is it a small cloud?
Small
it, in the Small Magellanic Cloud, the only radio pulsar known happens to be going around the B star. It's quite amazing. And in the Parkes multi-beam survey, a third one of that type was discovered, and we don't know at the moment what the companion is. But this is the radial velocity curve of the pulsar, where you clearly see that the orbit is very eccentric. And that system, the companion, has a mass of at least 11 solar masses. It's not very well known. There is a K star, a K giant at the position, but it's at this moment not clear whether that really is a counterpart. It could also be a B star like in the other two systems. Anyhow, so we have five types of binary pulsars, five categories. Which I may summarize here again. Recycled pulsars with neutron star companion. Oh, sorry. And they have eccentric orbits. The Hall-Steller pulsar is the example. Recycled pulsars with low mass white dwarf companions. Circular orbits, most millisecond pulsars are like that. Recycled pulsars with massive white dwarf companions and circular orbits. A number of them are known, eight at the moment. And then non-recycled pulsars with massive white dwarf companions with eccentric orbits. Probably two of them we know. And then there are the massive stars, non-recycled pulsars with a massive normal companion star. And they always have also very eccentric orbits. Now it is particularly this type, number three and number four, the massive white dwarfs cannot be remnants of low mass stars, they must be remnants of intermediate mass stars, and they give us the information that neutron stars can be born as companions to intermediate mass stars. It's especially from the Parkes multi-beam survey that a number of these systems with recycled pulsars and massive white dwarfs have been recently discovered. The recycled ones you always recognize from the very long spin-down time scales and the rather short pulse periods, less than 100 milliseconds, and very long spin-down time scales. But here is one from the Parkes multi-beam survey, which is an ordinary pulsar with a short spin-down time scale. It's not recycled. It is in a very short period binary, 0.2 days. It has an eccentric orbit, and it has a rather massive companion. We do not really know whether the companion is a white dwarf, but it seems likely. There is still a small possibility that it's also a neutron star. That would be really interesting if this one is a neutron star, because it would be the first case where we see a young pulsar with a neutron star companion. But we don't know whether it's a neutron star. There is no optical identification for the thing. And there is quite strong arguments that it's likely to be a white dwarf, actually. Now, just to look at the masses of these things, this is a rather old picture, but I added a couple of... I hope it's not going too fast. No. This is a picture from an older paper by Camillo, where he plotted the masses of the white dwarfs against the orbital periods, against the spin periods of the pulsars. And then you see that there are, of course, the spin period, the millisecond spin periods with all these low mass helium white dwarf companions, and also some with long periods, long spin periods with these low mass helium white dwarfs. But those are systems with very, in general, with one exception, with very wide orbits. This is a strange one, and Martin van Kerkwijk and I differ of opinion on how it has been formed. Well, shouldn't go into the details here. But the ones which are really interesting is the group with the massive white dwarf companions, and which are recycled. And in the diagram of 96, there were only four of them, but Parkes has turned up another five of these systems. The orbital periods of these systems are always in the range of a couple of days to about 12 days now. Yeah, I say here 0.45, but the recycled ones have only orbital periods of ranging from about 2 days to 12 days. The ones with the helium white dwarf companions have a much larger range of orbital periods. Now, the ones with the helium white dwarf companions, we think we understand their history completely. It's really long known how, if you start out with a low mass star and a neutron star in the binary, when the low mass star, say one solar mass star, leaves the main sequence, it has a degenerate helium core hydrogen shell burning around the core. It's the lower mass star in the system. The neutron star is more massive. And so the mass transfer is stable, goes on a nuclear time scale. And so you see after 40 million years, the star has lost 0.44 solar masses. It's slowly expanding on an evolutionary time scale. And then after about 77 million years, it has lost its entire hydrogen envelope, and only a little helium white dwarf is left next to a neutron star. In this system, the mass transfer rate is always not larger than the Eddington limit, and in principle, the star could transfer its entire envelope to the neutron star. Whether that really happens, we don't know. It seems that the masses of millisecond pulsars, as far as we know them, are not that high. In this case, it would become a neutron star of almost two solar masses. But in any case, you transfer a lot of matter. It's transferred through a disk. It spins up the star. And this scheme was devised to get this millisecond binary pulsar, which indeed has an orbital period of just 118 days. So that seems well understood how you get these milliseconds.
Can I ask a question? Because there's always this issue of rates, and I don't really want to get into that. trying to connect the low mass X-ray binary population to the null sec pulsars. But you know, many of the low mass X-ray binaries we see are Roche load filling at less than a day.
Yes.
Or maybe even say 8 hours, in which case they look, in which case it's a low mass main sequence star less than one, say.
Yes.
And this won't happen to it.
No.
So so this requires that it's a wide binary and that the star is above one, so that this happens in an interesting time scale. Right?
Yeah. It's about one solar mass, it's enough.
So this fate is true for stars that are between, let's say, 0.8, so that it evolves in a Hubble time, and 1.
Yeah, you can have this, I think, almost up to two solar masses. You will go through a too high mass transfer phase for a while, but then it will settle to a lower transfer rate. Yeah, this basically can go up to about two solar masses. But your problem then is what happens to these narrow ones with a very little companion star, which do not evolve on a nuclear timescale. Yeah, you would think you whittle down the star completely by gravitational radiation. A thing like Skoweck's one, which has 0.86 orbital period, 0.86 days, actually is an intermediate case. You cannot get it to fill the Roche lobe if it were completely unevolved. So it must have also had some nuclear evolution. Well, people have been making all these calculations, but what in the end happened to these systems with the hydrogen, purely hydrogen star, it will turn into a degenerate star in the end, I think, when you have whittled it down to less than one-tenth of a solar mass. And there's a lot of people who have done evolutionary calculations on these things. But the ones which we see as millisecond pulsars with helium white dwarf companions all in some way or another have had an evolution of this type, but not necessarily going to these long periods. If you start out with a shorter orbital period, say around a day or so, with magnetic braking also included, you keep the systems at a rather short orbital period. Say they finish between a day and 10 days or something like that. Now to the ones with the high mass white dwarf companions. Those are the ones without a star in this diagram. Most of them, as I said, came from this new Parkes multi-beam survey. This is for an assumed orbital inclination of 60 degrees and a neutron star mass of 1.4, then you get white dwarf masses like this. So all, say, between half a solar mass and 1.2 solar masses. The orbital periods of the systems, as you see, are, with a few exceptions here, these are very short, but most of them between 2 days and 15 days. And Thomas Taurus, who was working in my institute, decided to start, he was a postdoc for a couple of years, decided to try to find evolutionary models to produce such systems. And what he realized is that if you have a companion star, say of 2, 3, 4 solar masses, 5 solar masses, which is in a rather tight system of orbital period of a few days, then after leaving the main sequence, the companion star, when it fills the Roche lobe, still has a radiative envelope. And that is a very important thing, because if you have a radiative envelope, you can have this thermal timescale mass transfer. If the envelope is convective, so if you go to a wider system, so the star has already a kind of giant structure when it fills the Roche lobe, then this is pretty catastrophic, because a convective envelope is violently unstable, wants to expand when you take mass off it, and then you get into a common envelope phase. But these systems, when you start out with orbital periods which are shorter than, say, something like, I'll show in a few minutes how many days, but sort of the order of a few days, then the envelope of the star is still in radiative equilibrium, and when you have that, you can transfer mass on a thermal time scale. Now, on a thermal time scale, in these rather massive companions, say four solar mass stars, so the mass transfer rate is highly super Eddington. But still, you don't get into a common envelope phase, and it is possible that a neutron star, because it has an Eddington luminosity then, can blow away the rest of the matter which is transferred to it, which is more than, it's just accreting at the Eddington limit and blows out the excess matter transferred to it. Now, if you make some assumptions on what happened to this matter which is blown out, you could say matter is transferred through a disk, and the assumption which Thomas made in these calculations is that it's then blown away from the neutron star with the orbital angular momentum of the neutron star, because it is matter which is connected with the neutron star after this mass transfer. And if you do that, you give it the specific orbital angular momentum of the neutron star. And if you then calculate the evolution, and you made a very large number of these calculations using Eggleton's evolution code, then you typically find that this system, starting out with an orbital period of 4 days, the orbital period first goes down when the star reaches a mass of 2 solar masses, it reaches the minimum orbital period, and then it finishes as a 0.6 solar mass CO white dwarf with an orbital period of about 8 days. Most of the time, the mass transfer is highly super Eddington, so you won't see it as an X-ray source. Only in the beginning half million year, it is below Eddington, so it could, for a short while, have been an X-ray source. And in the HR diagram, this companion evolves like indicated here, and it finishes as a massive CO white dwarf. So to get a system with this type of orbit and this type of white dwarf, you must have started out, say, with something, you could have started out with something like a 4 solar mass companion. Now, we did many of these calculations, and the outcome is a pretty complicated diagram here. What is plotted here is the mass of the final white dwarf against the final orbital period for systems starting out with companions of 5, 4.5, 4, 3.5, 3, 2.5, and 2 solar masses. The dark parts are systems which leave CO white dwarfs. The gray parts are helium white dwarfs. Now, in this diagram, I plotted the binary pulsars that we know with the white dwarf masses and orbital periods. These are the stars. Orbital periods are all in this range between half a day and say, 15 days. Case B is systems where the companion overflows the Roche lobe after it has left the main sequence, so after it has ended core hydrogen burning. Case A are systems which are so close that the companion was still in the hydrogen burning phase when it started to overflow the Roche lobe. And so you see that you can still get CO white dwarfs also from such systems, white dwarfs in the mass range of say 0.4 to 0.6 solar masses. But in any case, it seems that one can get these masses of the white dwarfs that we observe, except in this range. Now, once you go to the longer orbital periods, indicated here are only the final orbital periods, but the initial orbital periods of these systems in case B are only a few days. In case A, they are less than a day or something like that. If you go to wider systems where the star has a convective envelope when it overflows the Roche lobe, you get common envelope evolution. And these are the thin lines which we have here, which is called case C. And it seems that those guys you can only have gotten from common envelope evolution of wider systems. And these are particularly the massive white dwarfs in the very narrow final orbits, of which there are three of them. And basically those are systems which just went in a common envelope phase. In this case, the outcome is that you get a helium star or so, which can go through a second common envelope phase later on, and then you finish with a star less than 8 solar masses. You finish with a massive white dwarf and a neutron star in a circular, very narrow orbit. So those are what, basically they are quite similar to the ones which are the progenitors of the double neutron stars. If you start out with a somewhat higher mass of the companion, you may finish with two neutron stars. But it seems that then that the systems with high mass white dwarfs and very short orbital periods, they must have come through this common envelope phase. This is important because they're very similar, as I said, to the double neutron stars. The only thing is that apparently the companion was a little below the mass for making a neutron star. It was almost there. So if you have a 7 solar mass companion, it's one which almost...
Wait, so let me understand the picture for a 5 solar mass star.
Yeah.
Maybe that was the point you showed. So one of these is going to make a massive white dwarf. So the
This is the ones which started out with rather short orbital periods, so they still have the radiative envelope, so they can go through this mass transfer phase where you blow out matter, but you do not get into a common envelope. But it's also possible with the 5 solar masses, if you start out with a wider orbit, that you go through a common envelope, and then you finish with this white dwarf masses and these orbital periods in this range.
Right, so for an initially wide binary that doesn't fill, I've forgotten what my case is, so...
Case C, basically.
Okay, thank you. So so if I start with the 5 solar mass star, that's in a really wide...
Oh, sorry, this is the 5 solar mass common envelope, and this is the 5 solar mass not going into a common envelope.
Right.
Yeah.
So do you include mass loss to infinity, not from mass transfer, but from just...
Yeah, you just lose the entire envelope in this case, basically.
But just for the normal reason you do in an isolated star, not because of mass transfer.
Basically, yeah, if the star were isolated, it would go to the asymptotic giant branch and then blow out its envelope and you're left with a white dwarf. Now, if you have the neutron star going in an orbit, as soon as it overflows its lobe, you get into a common envelope phase, and during the spiral in, by the friction on the orbit, when the neutron star is in the envelope of the other star, you blow off prematurely the envelope, basically, and you also finish with a white dwarf. The white dwarf may be a little bit less massive than in the case of a single star, because there the evolution still goes on, while here you abort it, basically, because when you start the common envelope phase, there is no more shell burning which can increase the mass of the white dwarf. So the white dwarfs are somewhat lower mass than you would get from a single star. But not very much.
How much above Eddington does the mass transfer become, say, for example, a 5 solar mass companion?
Oh, very much. You mean with the case of the radiative envelope? Yeah, it's...
You showed one that was above 1,000 times Eddington.
So. It's going to... It's probably going above it.
So but then how are you sure that that's going to happen instead of a...
Well, there is no need, if you start out with a narrow system where you still have a radiative envelope of the donor star, there is no need to go into common envelope. The donor can stay just at its Roche lobe, because if you take some mass off, it shrinks enough to do that.
But only at the expense of assuming that you can...
transfer a lot of mass to the other star. Well, I think actually a thing like SS-433 might be showing something like that, you know, because there you see of the order of 10 to the minus 6 solar masses a year coming out in these relativistic beams. It's a binary with a 13-day orbit. We do not know what the companion is in the case of SS-433, but it might be a case like that where you...
So
Yeah, the transfer rate is highly super-Eddington in SS4C. You see these funny beams coming out. Whether that's really one of those systems, but it seems an attractive idea that this might be some of those systems. Now, where do you have that you can stabilize this mass transfer, where you have the radiative envelopes? It's a bit a funny diagram here. This is the mass of the companion, and this is the orbital, initial orbital period of the system. And this whole white region is where you can have stable mass transfer, which of course is highly super-Eddington, but then you lose a lot of mass, but the system does not need to go into common envelope. And this gray area, the systems all go into common envelope, and then they spiral in. In this case, there is not enough energy in the orbit to keep a binary, so the neutron star spirals completely into the core of the other star. And what happens in that case, we don't know, but probably becomes a black hole. This is below the red line. Well, what's the now, this was all for binary neutron stars, where the neutron stars recycled, where we had mass transfer to the neutron star spun up, you get a circular orbit, white dwarf, massive white dwarf, and a recycled neutron star. But we have also these two systems where we have a young white dwarf, a young pulsar going around a white dwarf in an eccentric orbit. And clearly in these systems the neutron star was formed after the white dwarf. And to do that, in the unevolved system, the progenitor system, the companion star, the original primary star, must have had a mass too low to form a neutron star, so it left the white dwarf. But after the mass transfer, the other star was massive enough to form a neutron star. And Thomas Towers and his student, Senels in Copenhagen, tried to model such systems. And for example, they took a system starting out with a 7 solar and a 5 solar mass star in a 10-day orbit. And when you evolve that system, when it's 47 million years old, the 7 solar mass star has left the main sequence, it transfers mass, it leaves a 1.48 solar mass helium star, and the companion becomes 10.5 solar mass. That's enough to make a neutron star later on. Now this helium star evolves further and becomes a white dwarf, 0.86 solar masses.
Wait, slow down. So how'd you get from 1.48 to 0.86? What happened there?
This is 1.48.
Yeah.
Oh, the helium star, helium burning helium stars during a later evolution expand. They become a kind of giants with a CO core, because the helium burning produces carbon and oxygen in the core. And the helium mantle expands, and so you get a further mass transfer, so you it loses another 0.6 solar masses of the helium to the other star.
No, but that's all right. The other star didn't increase. It went to infinity.
Yeah, I that's...
Or do you think this is a typo?
No, he must have used the wind blast.
Yeah, he probably assumed that it went through a wind. I would not agree with that, actually. I think it should be transferred in this case.
Is it clear that a pure helium star actually has something that looks like a red giant?
Yes. Yeah. When helium stars are below about 3.5 solar masses, they go through a giant phase. Yeah. That's a long known thing. Paczynski calculated that already 30 years ago. Yeah, helium stars evolve a bit like hydrogen stars. Well, they're further to the left in the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, but the lower mass helium stars below about 3.5 solar masses go to the right in the HR diagram and go to some kind of a giant phase. And especially the ones with this mass, they really go to the giant fins. So I would presume that he should have put, I think, the 0.6 on top of that star, but apparently he assumed it went out in the wind or something like that. Then when the system is 70 million years old, the other star, the 10 and a half solar mass star, overflows the Roche slope. You get into a common envelope phase. And what comes out, you lose the entire envelope. What comes out is the helium core of this 10 and a half solar mass star, which is almost 3 solar masses, with the white dwarf in a very narrow orbit. And this helium star is massive enough to explode as a supernova. Yeah, and then, of course, you can put in things like Kix and Taurus and Cenos put the Kix distribution in there. Random orientation of the Kix. There is a variety of assumptions you can make about these Kix, of course. In this case, with the direction of the kick, as indicated here, you finish up with a very eccentric system consisting of a young neutron star and a massive white dwarf. But of course, there's a lot of freedom, and they did an enormous amount of simulation, population synthesis. And it turns out you can get such systems where the white dwarf is first born and the neutron star is second born from a variety of combination of primary star and secondary star masses in this entire diagram, you can get these systems. You can get double neutron stars. You get neutron stars first born and white dwarf second born. Anyhow, but in any case, for this type of systems, there is a lot of possibility to make them. And now you can compare, of course, the produced systems was the theoretically predicted ones from the population synthesis. And here they took an average kick velocity for the neutron star of 500 kilometers a second and some Gaussian distribution of the around this average and random directions of the kicks. And these are all the theoretically produced systems with orbital eccentricity and orbital period, and these are the two observed systems of this type where the neutron star was born after the white dwarf. Now, it seems that they do not fit in the region where the mean of the distribution, where the bulk of the points are. This line indicates systems which have such narrow orbits that they will decay by gravitational radiation and coalesce to the left of this dashed line within 10 million years. So those systems you get rid of after a while. But that still does not help to explain why these things are so far to the right in the diagram. And it may be that the underlying assumptions in these simulations are still not realistic enough. There is also a possibility that systems with very high eccentricities and short orbital periods, such pulsars are very hard to discover, actually, because they have very high acceleration. And the reason why this thing was discovered is probably because it had this rather low eccentricity. It was rather easy to find in a pulsar survey. So whether this is really representing real life is not yet completely sure, I would think.
Is it actually difficult to find? Because most of the time you're at Astron and not accelerated that much at all, I would say.
I understand from the pulsar people that systems with very high eccentricities are rather difficult to find. But, yeah.
I would say at the same orbital period, it would almost be easier the more eccentric it is. But most of the time it's actually not accelerated that much at all.
Yeah, you would think so, yeah. At least this is what they suggest in their work, that might be the reason. But I'm not so sure. Of course, there are a lot of assumptions in these population synthesis models. And
specifically, common envelope.
Yes. Anyhow, the conclusion from this is that I think we can say that the existence of many recycled pulsars with massive white dwarf companions shows that binaries consisting of a neutron star and intermediate mass stars do exist in nature, say 1 to 7 solar masses. Now we know from the BE X-ray binaries that also upwards from 8 solar masses companions exist, so it seems that companions of all types basically exist in nature. The recycled pulsars with massive white dwarfs in the longer types of orbital periods descend from systems with relatively short periods in radiative envelopes, and similar systems with the short orbital periods probably descend from common envelope evolution of wider systems. And the eccentric orbit binary radio pulsars with non-recycled pulsars, the white dwarf was formed first. From these calculations, it appears that these calculations also produce double neutron stars, that these systems are much more common, the formation rate is much higher than that of the double neutron star systems, at least an order of magnitude larger. And that may be the reason why we see here systems where we see the last formed neutron star. We never have seen those yet in the double neutron stars. For some reason or another, we only see that the recycled pulsar. We have never seen the newborn pulsar, and that may be due to the fact that the formation rate of these systems is lower. And the recycled ones you see for a much longer time than the newborn pulsar. Okay, that's what I wanted to tell you.
Questions?
Yeah, well,
I was
going
to ask, what would the occurrence be of a system that's accreting at 100 or 1,000 times energy? Are there any limits to
the geometry of asking problems? You mean from the number of binary pulsars we see, can we go back and see?
Right. Well, can we ask, are the numbers consistent? Just like people said, between LMXBs and LMXBs.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you, first of all,
how do they look like?
How do they look?
Yes, yes.
They should look like SS-432, maybe.
Yeah, well, they may look like SS-433, but there are not many SS-433s in the galaxy. Yeah, you saw in this four solar mass system that it lasted pretty long. Let me see, how long did it last? Of the order of 1,000,000 years or so. SS-433 has been around for at least 30,000 years, I think, to blow the ears into this shell which is around it, but that's still much shorter than this, actually. That's a good question, yeah, but I don't know the answer to it.
Yeah, I was wondering about your scenario that you say is so sort of obvious, hardly merits discussion on the Lomas. Isn't it slightly embarrassing that the Lomas X-ray binaries, none of them actually show pulsations? There's really no evidence for magnetic field.
Hey, there is one.
There's one, yes.
SACS 1808.
That has a brown dwarf companion, but that does not form a helium light dwarf, for sure.
But it looks so much like all the other guys. I think it is a low mass X-ray binary.
It probably forms a black widow pulsar.
But your problem,
something like Cygnus X2, which is such a beautifully nice progenitor of a helium light dwarf system, or maybe that's actually not such.
No, that goes into a CO perhaps.
But anyway, why does it not show any sign of a magnetic field anymore? I mean, you really think that will come back?
Well,
without a magnetic field.
I'm not so sure whether it does not show a sign of a magnetic field. It does show all these QPO phenomena. And now it depends on your QPO theory, of course, whether that's connected to magnetic fields. But I believe that the Illinois models and so connected with magnetic fields typically of the order that you see in millisecond pulses.
So you're not uncomfortable with the idea that we know that one pulsar with regular one neutron star with regular accretion rates is such J1808 shows very beautiful persistent emission, very clear, so easy to detect, and all the others show absolutely nothing. I mean, that sort of shows you that there is something very, very different.
Well, don't forget that SACS-1808 is a transient. It is a source which is on the lower edge of mass transfer rates.
So it's an explorer, so it's a clear X1.
Yeah.
Nice persistence X-ray pulsations.
Yeah, but this one shows what we would have expected. It shows a 2.5 millisecond.
But this is groundwork, and why not all the others? I mean, I think that's my whole point. I mean, that will show it so clearly. Then if all the others really had similar magnetic fields.
The Illinois model assumes that there is a cloud conveniently hiding these pulsations. It's the only way in which they can do this.
Yeah.
And 1808 shows that that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there may be something in 1808 that it is the geometry of which we look at the orbit or whatever.
Rephrase my question a little bit. Do you see any way of making all these lamas, the ones where you say you already have a good scenario, but I'm just saying, suppose that scenario actually turns out to be completely wrong for what I said, they just don't have magnetic fields, bad luck. Can you make them by way of one of the quick mass transfer rates?
Now this quick mass, this type, huh?
Yes.
The outcome, if you look at the outcome, and if you look at the recycled pulsars with massive white dwarfs, they have systematically longer pulse periods than the one with the helium white dwarfs. You saw this in this Camillo picture, which seems to suggest that, their mass transfer timescale was shorter than the ones with the helium white dwarfs. So if you transfer matter longer, you spin them up faster. That seems all consistent with each other, I would think. And so I cannot really see a problem with these guys descending from low mass X-ray.
There's one slightly annoying problem that you don't see causations very, very definitely would expect them to have. I mean, I would say it's sort of deadly.
Well, I don't know.
I would think this SACS-1808 looks to me like a nice missing link, which we were always looking for.
Why all the others, why don't they show causation? Now that you know that you can see it, you really have to ask why the others.
Yeah, you ask a very good question. I don't know the answer to it.
In the case of the rapid burster, there aren't any pulsations, but we are fairly sure that it's a strong enough magnetic field there to modulate the accretion.
I would not use the rapid burster as a strong argument for any.
Well, it's exactly because you're a counterexample, that's all.
Yeah, that's.
So the most powerful
example for what? Sorry.
Yeah.
For
example for what?
For something probably has at least a modest magnetic field, and nonetheless doesn't show pulsation.
But you say that only because it's different than the others, and therefore it's a magnetic field.
Yeah.
But you have one object that shows pulsations, and you have one object that, you know, one object that Chris just brought up that has, you think has a strong magnetic field that doesn't show pulsations. So if you throw out one of those, you should throw out both, right? Those are two extremes, and then you have this whole population in between.
I think what the rapid burster shows you is that there can be an appropriate orientation for the magnetic field with respect to the spin that will not give you pulsations.
Yeah, so there's a range of answers, it looks like.
You have to be very careful about deducing anything about the magnetic field in the absence of pulsations.
Okay, so let me change the subject. So let me ask about the coalescence rate of the white dwarf neutron star body mass. So you talked about the frequency, but I couldn't quite tell with the orbital period folded in, is that the coalescence rate per unit volume of the massive white dwarf neutron star binaries, how does that compare to the double neutron star binaries?
Their formation rate is is higher by an order of magnitude, so you would also expect the coalescence rate.
Well, that sort of depends on the orbital period distribution of when they're born. Are they born in comparable orbital periods? In terms of the rate, you know, rate where they actually coalesce.
They are born with quite a lot. You see quite some small orbital periods. Eh? You see here all these guys, they coalesce.
But those coalesce in a million years.
Ten million years.
This line. Can draw a line at the Hubble. Right?
Yeah, but
I think we can do observational statistics right here. Two very fast coalescing neutron star binaries, and only one which also will coalesce very fast, but which lives much longer, much shorter observationally. So I think even from just observations, you need to get already a factor of 10 more white dwarf binary neutron star.
Yeah, well, from this Taurus and Sennel simulations, they say that it's about between 20 and 30 times higher formation rate of these eccentric young neutron star white dwarf systems than the double neutron star systems, and I would think then also the coalescence rate would be of that order. Actually, what you would get in that case, I would think, you destroy the white dwarf in these systems when they coalesce. You might get a single millisecond pulsar, actually, of some
or
sort.
It's a gamma ray burst model.
Is it a good gamma ray burst model?
Well, but you're anti hook band and fields to drive the burst, so then you kind of start hand waving and say what you want. If magnetic fields work for the other mechanisms, they should just as well work for this one.
But do you get the gamma ray burst by driving the neutron star over its upper mass limit and making a black hole out of it, or what?
Not necessarily just driving over the mass limit, but you will form an accretion disk of this neutron star.
But is that enough to get a gamma ray burst?
It's how efficient you are at extracting this energy.
Okay.
By something.
Okay.
Well, I guess it'd be the problem with it is the central engine timescales are already starting out pretty long. I mean, the orbital period is probably
make
10 or 20 seconds.
It's
only make Roche loop filling, so at least a source, I guess.
It's the same thing with the white dwarf black hole mergers. You can have the same problem. It's only going to make a long duration burst of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What I find an interesting aspect of this white dwarf neutron star, the massive white dwarf neutron star systems, which are formed by from common envelopes, so the recycled ones, is that it seems then that you could get a 7 solar mass star with a neutron star which goes into the common envelope, and the neutron star not becoming a black hole in the process, which, for example, people like Jerry Brown and company for the double neutron stars have as an argument against making them from the spiral in evolution, that the neutron star would turn into a black hole when it goes in an envelope
couldn't you do it with the same scenario though, with the two, well, I guess if you got two helium stars that are almost the same mass, it becomes a little bit fine-tuning.
But it seems to me that the fact that we see these very massive white dwarfs in a couple of them in rather short orbital periods, like a day or so, circular orbits, so they must have come from, say, 6-7 solar mass rather wide systems where the neutron star plunged into the envelope of the 6 or 7 solar mass star and survived the plunge and the spiral in, that you could make the double neutron stars. If you go a little higher, say, to a 10 solar mass star where the neutron star goes in, then you don't get a white dwarf with the neutron star.
You could do like what Martin just said, you can still form them with a Jerry Brown like mechanism where they're roughly the same mass.
Yeah, the helium stars.
And so you have, when you do this spiraling, you go into common envelope, you're not forming that neutron star or white dwarf until the tubes. The two stars initially are almost the same mass, so you evolve in that way. So
Then you have an extremely narrow window also to make these white dwarf neutron star systems, I would say.
Yeah.
And here you apparently don't. Well, you don't need that.
Is any mass measurements for these neutron stars that must have gone through the common envelope stage?
Well, yeah.
The companion would be one, I guess.
They are, I think, well, in the double neutron star systems, do we have measurements of companion, of neutron star masses? You must.
Sure, I mean, the Rothschild telescope.
Oh, yeah. Those are the, yeah, sorry.
Sorry.
No, but I mean the white dwarf neutron star.
Oh, no, white dwarf neutron star.
There's nothing, huh?
Well,
it has not gone through. The neutron star is a newborn neutron star, so nothing has happened to it. But in any case, it seems that neutron stars can have companions of any type of mass, which I think is quite an interesting new development.